Tar sands is also triggering an energy crisis of its own kind. This may sound like an oxymoron. How can something that produces energy end up creating an energy crisis? Well, there are a number of factors that we need to recognize here, but most importantly, we need to understand that the tar sands, in spite of the proponents who say that it is a panacea for the energy woes of the future, really ends up being much more of a false solution for a variety of reasons. One of the reasons is that it perpetuates the kind of addiction to oil for some time to come by getting people hooked on dirty oil to replace conventional oil. And that's what's happening in the world today as we move increasingly from conventional oil production to unconventional oil production, such as the tar sands. One of the reasons that this is happening, of course, is that on a global scale, we are very close to peak oil production. That is to say, we are running out of oil that can be produced. And certainly we are running out of conventional oil, such as we have produced it for well over a century and a half in our civilization. The world demand for oil is on the rise. Right now it hovers between 80 and 84 million barrels a day. But by the year 2030, that number will jump to probably 116 million barrels a day, especially with China and India and an expanding growth in the United States. So there is no question that we are in a situation where demand is rising, but supplies are dwindling, and certainly the easy-to-get-at supplies have almost dried up. So those supplies that are going to exist in the future are going to be the hard-to-get-at, such as the tar sands, such as offshore drilling in the Gulf areas, such as the Arctic region itself. But you know, the whole issue of the energy crisis and the tar sands comes at us in a different way. And that is, we are well aware of the fact, as we indicated before, that a great deal of natural gas is used to heat for tar sands production. But we are running out of natural gas, at least conventional natural gas, in this country. Geologists tell us that we have less than 8.9 years of supply left of conventional natural gas. Now, well, folks, this is a pretty hard reminder because, you know, a great deal of homes across this country depend upon natural gas to heat them during the wintertime itself. And the amount of natural gas that the tar sands uses every day equals to half the amount of natural gas that's used to heat homes in this country. So we are finding ourselves in a very, very serious situation with regards to natural gas and our future needs. There may be the building of the Mackenzie gas pipeline to bring natural gas down from the Beaufort Sea in the Mackenzie Delta, but that project has been delayed and delayed and put off, and it may not happen in time for the kind of crunch that we may be finding just up the road a bit. The opposite possibility is that we may end up turning to nuclear energy reactors to fuel the tar sands in order just to free up a little bit more conventional gas, natural gas, to serve our own needs. But we are in a difficult situation with regards to our own future in terms of natural gas. But let's also look at another part of the country. Let's look at Quebec and the Atlantic provinces and recognize the extent to which they are very vulnerable themselves. You know the phrase, "Let the eastern bastard freeze in the dark"? Well, that was a bumper sticker that was around in Alberta in the 1980s during the National Energy Program fiasco. But in many ways, if you look at what's happening in our country today, that's not far from the truth. That is to say that over a third of the population of this country is dependent on foreign oil imports. The Atlantic provinces and Quebec and even parts of Ontario depend on Algeria, Saudi Arabia, and Iraq for their oil, not on Alberta. Most of Alberta oil goes to the United States. It does not serve Canadian needs. We do not have a national energy policy and strategy in this country. And that's something that many of us perhaps aren't that aware of or that cognizant of. So what happens when there are shortages? What happens when the squeeze is on globally? What happens if there is a political struggle that results in OPEC taking retaliatory action? Then one-third or over one-third of our population is going to be left vulnerable to those kinds of oil shockwaves. And they are not too far in the future. But one of the most difficult problems we have to recognize is that we do not just have, no longer have a national energy policy in this country. It is simply a no energy policy. It is a, in other words, NEP stands for something else today. It stands for no energy policy. And I think this is something that we need to think about very deeply. The extent to which we are really, if we're honest with ourselves, not much more than an energy satellite of the United States. And that's what we've become locked into and allowed ourselves to become locked into. And we have no transition plan to move from a civilization and society that's based on fossil fuels to one that's based upon renewable energy alternatives. There is no serious plan ahead. And we continue to rely on the tar sands as a way of saying, well, we don't have to worry about that. We got all that stuff in the tar sands. That can last us for many, many years. But meanwhile, a crisis is brewing, and it's brewing all around us. And we need to recognize this, that we are not the new energy superpower. We are really more of a satellite, and much of our power had been surrendered under the North American Free Trade Agreement and the control over our energy sources at that time. Finally, I want to walk through a little bit on the new petropolitics that I think that we are faced with today. We are living in a different world. This is not the 1980s when the National Energy Program was fashioned. This is a world characterized by some other kinds of forces at work, not the least of which is what we've just discussed, peak oil. We're running out of recoverable conventional energy sources or oil sources, I should say. Climate change, which is knocking us on the head, and yet we are creating an industry or have created an industry and a mega machine that is generating multiple forms of greenhouse gas emissions and global warming. And then coupled with that is the deepening water crisis that exists, and add to that the economic crisis that we have been talking about. And all of this needs to be put together in the context of the geopolitics of our time, and a geopolitics that is changing given the recent election of Barack Obama in the United States. If we look at the situation in the U.S. today, we find that, and we can't get away from this, that one quarter of the world's oil is consumed by the United States, and that amounts to roughly 20 million barrels a day at the present time. 58% of this is imported, which really amounts to actually around 12 million barrels a day. But some analysts say it's closer to 13.5 million barrels a day that's imported, that's really imported. And that Canada has moved into the number one slot ahead of Saudi Arabia as the U.S., the number one supplier of the U.S. for oil in the world. And at a meeting in Houston in January 2006, U.S. officials sat down with Canadian officials, including representatives of the oil companies, and the U.S. officials made it very clear that they expect that Canada will multiply its production and export five times by the year 2020. And that's going to all come from the tar sands. We also need to keep in mind that in the United States, oil is just not just some other product. It's something that is very much associated with national security. looking at all the national security doctrines of recent presidents, oil is front and center. Control over oil supply is front and center. And the military power of the United States is used and exercised to maintain control over those oil supply lines around the world. China and Russia pose real threats at the present time to the United States and different parts of the world. And the U.S. continues to move its operations around the world to take advantage of those moments and to be able to continue to secure control over those supply chains and supply lines. How much of this and to what extent any of this is going to change under the new administration remains to be seen. We cannot discount the fact that much of this could continue. We need to keep in mind that fueling America is a big part of the plans for the future that have been going on for some time. The map behind me shows that there are many more pipelines that are being proposed to bring gas from the Arctic and from the Mackenzie down into the tar sands area and also from Alaska, that this in turn will be used to develop and push pipelines and delivery systems into the U.S. with refineries in the U.S. and upgraders up in Alberta in what's called Upgraders Alley, which is just north of Edmonton. All of this is a part of a new industrial heartland in Alberta, coupled with a huge delivery system to the United States, as indicated in this map itself. But the real question, I guess, that we are all having to wrestle with, is it going to make a difference that Obama has been elected in the United States on a great wave of popularity and a great historical moment? There's no doubt that Barack Obama put forward in his election platform something called New Energy for America, a whole new plan for dealing with energy consumption and also with greenhouse gas emissions. And in his plan, he called for a reduction of consumption in the United States, 6.5 million barrels of oil a day, a reduction of 6.5 million barrels of oil a day by the year 2025 or the latest 2030. Those plans were made before the economic crisis and the financial meltdown that has occurred, and so it's difficult to know for sure where those plans stand. Equally interesting was the fact that Obama also said, or his officials said very clearly during the election campaign, that tar sands oil would be considered to be dirty oil and unlikely to meet the standards that would be set by an Obama administration for greenhouse gas emissions. So there may be some good signs on the horizon, but we don't know for sure. And as a result, we need to take a look at that hard and understand whether or not the markets are going to be there for tar sands crude, at least in the United States. If the market isn't there, then it will be elsewhere, such as in China or India or somewhere else, and we have to look out for that. But for the moment, all the infrastructure, as that previous map indicated, are being planned and built to deliver tar sands crude to the United States. There is, of course, one juggernaut that stands in the way, and that is NAFTA itself. Because under NAFTA, in the energy chapter of NAFTA, makes it very clear that through the proportional sharing agreement that only Canada has with the United States, and not Mexico, by the way, as a part of this, Canada is obligated to continue supplying increasing amounts of oil to the United States based on the average of the previous 3 years. And it's a built-in escalator clause that has existed since 1989. And as a result, our exports have gone up and up and up and up, and we are obligated to continue that level of exports to the United States. There are all sorts of other moves that have been made to try to turn the entire continent of North America into a national energy commission, being oversighted by a national energy commission. Discussions that have been going on in the Security and Prosperity Partnership for the establishment of this North American Energy Commission. And it's again questionable as to what President Obama will do about, President-elect Obama will do about that. He has indicated that he has real problems with the Security and Prosperity Partnership. We may see a change, we may not. But we need to be aware of the politics that is unfolding in the United States on that front. So I say in the end here that we are into a new era. It is a new era of petropolitics, and it's something that every citizen in this country, I think, needs to be aware of and be cognizant of as we start to charter these new waters into the future. One thing's for sure, that the tar sands is a huge mega energy project and development, that it's now at the center of our economy and the center of our politics, that even though we're going through an economic downturn now, this does not mean that suddenly the tar sands is finished, that it's over with, because as long as there is huge demand for access to the oil that can be produced, the dirty crude oil that can be produced from the tar sands, there will be a very strong emphasis on this industry. And we need to say that and need to ask ourselves some hard questions as Canadians. Because if the tar sands has moved into the center of our history and the center of our economy and politics, what kind of a future are we creating? What does this really mean? Are we making a transition into a future over which we will have very little control? Or are we making a transition into a future that takes seriously the environmental crises that we're facing, the energy crisis of the future, and also the economic crisis in front of us? Are we making a transition to a sustainable energy future and economy? Are we making sure that we have a sustainable energy and economic future? These are the hard questions which many Canadians are starting to ask themselves. And having a progressive administration south of us now in the United States may help us to cast this in a new light and see this in a new way. There is a resistance movement that has been growing and developing against the tar sands for these very reasons. Part of it exists, and much of it exists in the early stages in Alberta. It is now growing bit by bit across the country. And there are allies developed in the United States. Out of this is coming a burgeoning resistance movement that's not going to somehow be with us perhaps today and tomorrow and in a year from now, but it's going to grow and develop over the next 5 or 10 years. Stopping the tar sands and the level of production will not take place in a couple of years. It's something that will take several years to accomplish. And over the next number of years leading up to 2015 and 2020, commitments are being made by groups and organizations to carry this fight out over the time that is necessary. The call is for a moratorium now, a moratorium that's based on fundamental conditions that must be met. And these are going to be strong and hard conditions environmentally, strong and hard conditions in terms of energy transitions that need to be made, strong and hard conditions in terms of what we owe to the First Nations and Aboriginal peoples, also to the social impacts that are going on of the tar sands. A whole range of conditions are being laid out there by various groups and consolidated into a clear call for a moratorium based upon these conditions. But this is really setting the stage for what many of us call a permanent moratorium. And by that I simply mean that eventually, the tar sands production must come to a halt and it must be stopped forever. Because it is truly the most environmentally destructive project on the face of the planet. We can't do it overnight. We must build the support for it. That's what we see ahead of us is a long-term struggle. And that's why we are taking the book and this slideshow on the road to talk to Canadians and to get a dialogue going about where people's commitments are regarding the future of their country and the destiny of their country as it is affected by the tar sands. It is a choice and a decision that we all have to make, and yet it is a choice and a decision that lies at the very heart of where we are moving as a country, and it lies at the very heart of the future of the planet we inhabit. Thank you very much.
Questions and comments are most welcome at this time. Tony has asked that we group them, say, in groups of two. So two questions, one from, say, this side, one from this side, if we have demand on both sides. And then Tony will answer the duo, cover more people. If you have a comment, by all means, make a comment, and Tony will comment on your comment. So who will go first? Yes, sir.
Thank you. I just want to ask what you made of Mr. Parker's comments the day after Barack Obama was elected. He talked to Obama and started to talk about a North American cap and trade system for reducing greenhouse gas emissions. And I wonder if that's a good thing that happened. Originally, I thought maybe it was, but then I heard some people say maybe Parker's trying to take the initiative to preserve what he can in tar sands.
It seems to be
complex, so if you have a comment
on that, I'd like to hear that.
Questioner number two, please rise.
I've heard that natural gas can be turned into gasoline, that broken up paper from roads can be turned into gasoline. Anything that has the large carbon molecules in it can be jiggled around, but I have the distinct impression all of these require vast quantities of energy, and some of them probably are just totally inequitable. So, with that sort of thing in mind, the brief discussion of upgraders and refinery and what kind of water and natural gas is required for upgrading suggests to me that there must be a rethinking of society as we use it. The use of public transportation, heaven forbid, I don't like the idea of nuclear energy-driven trains by electricity and so on, but fueling by hydrocarbons, hydrocarbons from the ground, natural gas and oil, seems to be becoming totally unwieldy in the population we have and the people we have.
Thank you for those two questions. On the first one, you know, I think that in many ways it was really interesting watching through the election, the extent to which Harper was making different announcements that related somehow to the eventual move that was made just after Obama was elected. First of all, he said something about, in Calgary, he said something about that Canada would not be allowing shipments of bitumen to countries that didn't maintain certain environmental standards. And then he made an announcement to the effect that they were going to rethink some of their environmental standards in relationship to what was happening in the U.S. So these kinds of announcements were being made at different points in the election. So I think that there was a build-up to what happened, and I think it's not unrelated to Jim Prentice becoming Minister of the Environment now and taking over and steering a new agenda with regards to the Obama administration. So having said that, I think that there is this maneuvering going on. And part of it was generated by the fact that there was a huge resistance that had been built up by American groups, which got American mayors on side, which said that they would not accept dirty fuel, they would not accept the import of tar sands crude, and that they were all going back to their cities and municipalities to look at to what extent they were actually using tar sands crude. So all of this has been part of a political process now that's been unfolding. And I think that we need to see the announcement that was made within that larger context, that there has been maneuvering taking place around this. And there's no question that the Harper government plans to use its energy clout, if you will, to try to steer things in a certain direction. I think we have to watch very vigilantly as to what is really unfolding here, the details are still not there. We have to look very carefully at the details, and we have to recognize that this maneuvering is taking place. And it's going to be important to see to what extent our counterpart groups in the U.S. are able to get to the Obama administration to be able to point out some of the pitfalls and problems with what the Harper government is actually proposing. So I think these are things that are going to be a part of a process over the next number of months, especially and particularly after he is sworn in as president. The first 100 days is the period probably where these decisions are likely to be made. So I just want to hold it at that for a moment. I don't want to say anything more until we find out actually much more detail and much more about what's in the details regarding the proposal that's been made and what its implications really are. I am quite suspicious of it, as you can see, but that's all I'm going to say right now. Secondly, with regards to the other question about whether it's natural gas or other kinds of products or being able to take tar from the roads and turn it back into gasoline and all of that. And but it really boils down to that basic question you said at the end, pretty well phrased this way, and that is, you know, what is the future of hydrocarbons in our society? I mean, are we at the point where we're going to have to start moving in a new direction? And there's no question about this in my mind, because what's happening, and I'm picking up on your point, and that is that what's happening is that in order to get at these other remaining sources of fossil fuels, we are having to expend a great deal more energy to get at them. And that as a result, the return of energy, invested is a huge, huge gap. There's a huge gap between the two. And we need to recognize that and understand that. And that's certainly the case with the tar sands, because we end up using, as I said, a relatively clean fuel like natural gas, which is in limited quantities in the final analysis. We're trying using all that up in order to be able to simply get at the bitumen and the tar sands that lies behind. And turn that into tar sands crude for sale. And the upgraders that are used use a great deal of that natural gas as well as a great deal of water itself. So it's definitely a real problem of an imbalance in terms of the energy returns we get on the energy invested. And once you start to cross that threshold, we all ought to be asking some hard questions. And I think, therefore, we have to move in a new direction in terms of our energy future.
I know that I have read that the contamination from the tar sands is actually going to that contamination is going to reach the Great Lakes. And I wondered if you could expand on how that's going to, that process is going to unfold. Is it through watersheds or groundwater, or how that's going to take place?
Yes, the Great Lakes is going to be directly affected. And the place where it gets directly affected is a place called Port Whiting, which is in Indiana, and it borders right on Lake Michigan. As a result, the refinery there, where a great deal of tar sands crude goes to the Port Whiting refinery, and the effluent from that refining process spews right into the Great Lakes, therefore contaminating. But it also uses a great deal of water from the Great Lakes for that purpose. So there is a direct connection, you're absolutely right, with the Great Lakes, because we all know that what happens in Lake Michigan will also affect Lake Ontario and Lake Huron and Lake Erie, etc. So we are really definitely in the early stages of that development right there. The other big refinery in the Midwest, and there are refineries in several other places, as you saw from the map, but the other big refinery is the Woodbridge Refinery in Illinois. Doesn't really, it draws water from Lake Michigan, but it doesn't spew back into Lake Michigan as far as we know. But nevertheless, it is one of the biggest refineries of tar sands crude to be found in the United States, and it also it provides the jet fuel for O'Hare Airport and for United Airlines in particular as its biggest customer. So that's part of the analysis that some of our friends in the States have uncovered. and it'll be a part of the action, I'm sure, that we're going to see in the next year or two around those issues from a consumer standpoint. Over here to the question, or where has my friend gone? There she is over there. Yes, Saskatchewan is a big part of it. I think it's at this point somewhat unknown how big the deposits really are in Saskatchewan. They're not, at least the recoverable deposits aren't that large. But with new technologies, who knows what will happen in terms of recoverable deposits. What's happening, though, is that there's been a real new interest churned up in Saskatchewan. I am going there at the end of the month, and we're having workshops and all sorts of gatherings with people around the issue, and we're going to see, I think, a lot more interest. We were just meeting in the last 2 days of last week with activists from and campaigners from Alberta and from elsewhere in the country, and the Albertan campaigners expressed strong interest in working now much more closely with Alberta groups, with Saskatchewan groups, and we're going to see, I think, a lot more collaboration take place across those provincial boundaries and working on the issues. So there's no question that's going to be an important part. Let me add one more thing. You mentioned the new government, Saskatchewan government. They're gung-ho, of course, to go ahead with the development of the tar sands in Saskatchewan. But they're also gung-ho to go ahead with building 5 new nuclear reactors, some of which are designed to, or will be designed to serve tar sands production in Alberta, in Saskatchewan, but also potentially also to serve part of the energy needs that may be needed up the road a bit to replace natural gas for the Alberta tar sands. Again, though, keep in mind it takes roughly 10 years to build one of those nuclear reactors, and of course, I'm sure that most of us in this room have huge questions about the storage of that nuclear waste and what that really means.
There was a fair bit of controversy between the Conservatives and the Liberal parties during the past election on the one hand, carbon capture and sequestration as part of Dion's green shift, and then the second place on carbon trading and caps. And apparently the Conservative plan is not an absolute cap, it's a flexible cap based upon what are called efficiencies. Apparently in Canada has operated a carbon capture by dumping carbon dioxide and probably everything else as well into a saline aquifer since about 2000. I don't know whether this is a full production facility or simply a demonstration. Statoil has 3 such sites someplace in the world. I don't know where they are. Could you comment? Some comment has said, well, the carbon capture system is no more expensive than the trading and cap system. And various people have said, well, it may cost $15 billion or $20 billion and that sort of thing. Could you comment on this sort of
thing? Yeah. This question won't connect to that question. But it sounds like, bottom line, we need to transition off of fossil fuels. Comment and a question. Transitioning to what? And the question is, the comment is, the small group of us already in Dundas trying to answer this for ourselves, and where is the movement called Transition Towns, starting in the UK, focusing on curtailing our energy requirements and transitioning to more localized economies. How does that fit in your thinking? And how does it fit with this resistance movement you referred to earlier, Tony, to stopping, shutting down, or moratorializing the closing?
Okay. Thank you. Well, again, 2 really good questions. When it comes to carbon capture and storage or sequestration, that technology, as you know, is evolving and is far from being able to produce clear-cut results. And so the storage of carbon beneath the earth in various forms and pockets and things like that is something that is being explored, and the technology is being developed as we speak. Having said that, the costs that we have seen anyway vary enormously between some things that are sort of speculative versus you know, the real costs of what a certain piece of technology has garnered in terms of costs and price. But I think with the jury is still out in terms of how costly this will be. I quote in the book a number of academics who have looked at this question, and they say that it's, when you really put it all together, for the amount of actual proven results, the amount stored, in other words, versus the cost involved, it is, again, back to the problem of not enough return on the investment made. And I think therein lies one of the big problems that's going to arise. As you know, the federal government has sort of made a commitment that it wants to invest money into this and throw money at it, and is saying to the tar sands companies, we want you to move towards this CCS, this carbon capture and storage or sequestration by 2018, and have put out the markers for that. But the problem is they too don't know what they're talking about in terms of really what's in store here and what the technology is and what is proven technology and how much in the final analysis is going to cost. So I think that's as far as I've been able to take it right now. I was talking last week with a couple of people who have studied this at some length, and they're just shaking their heads and saying, look, there's just nothing there yet to really get enormously excited about, both in terms of a panacea and a solution to the problems as grandiose as they are going to be when we look at that chart and see the escalation of greenhouse gas emissions. Where is that all going to get stored, and using what technologies, and what will the cost be? So that's all about as much as I can say about that right now.